From the newsroom of PCJ Radio International, this is Focus Asia Pacific. I'm Keith Perron. Amnesty International says there's a high risk of violence at the Manus Island Detention Center. Now, the Papua New Guinea government has threatened to remove protesting refugees by force. Essential services like power and water were cut from the center last week, but about 600 refugees detained there for 4 years by Australia are refusing to leave. The refugees say they want to be resettled in a safe third country and that they fear further attacks by locals if they're moved to facilities in the island's main town. The government says due to the lack of hygiene and sanitation in the center, force may be used to relocate the men for the sake of their own health. It says essential services are available in other facilities, but Amnesty's Kate Schulzer told Ben Robinson Drawbridge those facilities are not at all ready.
What the PNG government is saying is that they will go in and forcibly remove refugees should they not leave the centre in 2 days. And of course, our concern is that this is a crisis of their own making. And now there's an extremely high risk of violence if they move into the centre and attempt to forcibly send them to other camps where they're still not ready to facilitate and accommodate those refugees, and especially to meet their health and security needs.
You said it was a crisis of their own making. The PNG government is saying that health and sanitation in the decommissioned centre is such that they have to leave. So is this a crisis of the refugees' making?
Well, essentially, when they cut the pipes to the tanks, they created this. And when they pulled away the generators that were supporting the centre, there was no logical basis for them to do this other than to add to the already inhuman treatment that these refugees have suffered over the last 4.5 years.
You've just come back from Manus, so you're not happy that the new accommodation facilities in Lorengau are ready?
No, they're not ready. They're not able to cope with the numbers of people. They're not yet secure and fully built sites. The East Lorengau Transit Centre, of course, has been open for some time, but that was built to accommodate 300 people. We have nearly 700 people on Manus in total right now.
But we're hearing about something called Camp 300 and Hillside House. What sort of state of readiness were they in when you saw them?
Well, Camp 300 is something we've never heard mentioned until this notice today. So I think the Australian and PNG government needs to come clean. Both of them have been propagating lies to say that Hillside House and the West Lorengau Transit Centre is now ready to accommodate refugees. And now all of a sudden they're announcing that there's some other campsite. We need to know where this is, what's going on, what the security arrangements are in place. I mean, it's really quite alarming that none of the concerns of the refugees around their safety and security, if they're moved closer to Lorengau, have been addressed in any of this.
What would the alternative be for the authorities? What do you think they should be doing?
There is a very clear and simple solution to this. Australia can end this crisis by bringing the men to Australia and offering them safety and protection here. But certainly what they could do in the interim is allow humanitarian access to the centre, medical professionals, allow them to have food and water, because this crisis that they've created is because they've actively blocked medical professionals going to that site, food deliveries coming to that site. They can relieve that pressure right now. Instead, what they're suggesting is that they will go in and use force to relocate these refugees. And given all the trauma that they've already suffered here at that site, it is quite alarming that they see that as their first option.
As the humanitarian crisis on Papua New Guinea's Manus Island deepens, one of the refugees detained there by Australia has been rescued by Canada. A detainee, Amir Tagahar, was an outspoken advocate for his fellow refugees and a vocal critic of Australia's inhumane offshore detention regime. And all the while, a group of Canadian citizens were quietly working behind the scenes to bring him to safety. Ben Robinson Drawbridge has more.
After fleeing religious persecution in Iran, Amir Taghinia made the mistake of seeking asylum in Australia. detained on Manus Island, his language skills earned him the moniker of teacher and made him a spokesman in the refugees' fight for freedom. His leadership impressed Canadian-Australian dual national Chelsea Taylor, who worked for the healthcare provider at the detention centre in 2014.
He is my absolute definition of strength and determination and resilience. And I believe that if he was given a chance to just have a life of freedom and given an opportunity to live in a country where he wasn't going to be persecuted, he would thrive.
Mr. Takinia learned of Canada's system of private sponsorship for refugees, and he made contact with Ms. Taylor after she'd returned to Australia.
And at that time, Amir asked if I knew of any organisation that might be interested in sponsoring him. So I approached my dad about it and said, look, we need to look into this and we need to do something. And that was how it sort of snowballed. We quickly identified that we as individual citizens could privately sponsor him. And so we got together a group of people and that wanted to make a difference and that were determined to help out one individual. And I think if we can do this, absolutely, it sets a precedent that every man that's currently being held on Manus Island has an opportunity to be resettled in a safe country.
Wary of false hope, Mr. Takinia quietly filled in the application using a decrepit mobile phone. Having become something of a leader, he was afraid of leaving the men, now resisting eviction from the centre. But failing health and no promise of remedy convinced the 24-year-old to board a flight for Canada last Thursday.
I have been welcomed so well and I have been treated just like any other Canadian here. And they consider me a Canadian from the first minute that I arrived in Canada. I will try my best to be a great person in this country that I can show how I appreciate everything that they have done for me.
A dozen residents of Vancouver's Coquitlam provided the $14,000 required for the sponsorship and are now fundraising more money to support Mr. Takinia in his new home. Ms. Taylor says they've no doubt that Australia's shame will be Canada's gain.
He will be someone who will go far, and as I've said many times, he will give back to Canada multiple times over, far more than that country will ever give him. He will be an absolute gift. The Canadians are lucky to have him.
Mr. Takinia says he'll continue to advocate for the refugees and asylum seekers Australia detains on Manus and Nauru.
The Australian people need to know that right now in Canada where I am, when people hear about Manus and all, they are disgusted. Reputation is something that takes years, decades and centuries to be built, and it takes a moment to be ruined, which for Australia has been ruined by what their government have done on Manus Island and Nauru. And my message to New Zealanders is make sure this does not happen to New Zealand.
Mr. Takinia says his family in Iran greeted news of his escape by singing the Canadian national anthem. This is Ben Robinson Drawbridge.
Tongan authorities are disappointed in the United States because they've released an American citizen who's wanted for murder in Tonga. Dean J. Fletcher faces charges in Tonga of murder with intent, murder by recklessness, manslaughter, and gravest bodily harm after he fled the country last year. U.S. federal agents arrested him in American Samoa, and he was placed in custody in Hawaii. Tonga has sought extradition, but the United States Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, has denied the request because his department is concerned that Mr. Fletcher would not have access to legal representation and that if convicted, he would face the death penalty. A U.S. government motion to dismiss the entire case has been granted. Tonga's acting Attorney General, Amisi Kefu, told Koro Vakawatu that they don't agree with the decision.
We are greatly disappointed. However, the warrant for his arrest and the indictment is still alive, and we will still pursue it.
What happens now if, according to what reports I've seen, the court has granted the government motion to dismiss the entire case and release the defendant? How does that impact, I guess, the indictment from Tonga's perspective?
The indictment is still alive. U.S. federal courts in the District of Hawaii had already found that he was eligible for extradition. However, the decision has to be made by the Secretary of State. Then he's come to this conclusion based on their concerns that Tonga is able to provide free legal counsel. We've explained that we don't have a legal system here in Tonga, and we feel that Fletcher was still able to engage counsel because before he absconded from the Tongan jurisdiction, he did engage senior lawyer here in Tonga and also a lawyer of experience from Auckland, New Zealand to represent him.
Is there an appeal process, or is this the decision has been made at such a high level that that's it?
There's no appeal. The functions of the courts have finished. Courts have found that he was eligible to be extradited. According to the U.S., they also held that Fletcher was unable to fund his own legal representation. And we've explained that he had already engaged counsel before. But that's a U.S. ruling, and the U.S. State Department is tied to that, and that's their position.
Tongan authorities are still pursuing him, but I guess if he doesn't leave the U.S., there's no way you could obtain him.
That's correct. So unless he goes to some other country where we have extradition arrangements with, then we'll restart the process there and hopefully bring him to justice.
The concerns outlined by the State Department, is that something that Tonga needs to work on or is working on, or they don't see it as a problem?
Providing free legal aid here has always been an issue, but it comes down to the government's resources, and we've never been able to do that. The only time that we did provide free legal aid was the assistance of New Zealand government when after a few hundred people were charged after the 2006 riots in Nukualofa. And Tonga tried to maintain that for a couple of years, but then we couldn't. So the issues have been on the table for a few years, and we're now looking at it more seriously.
And the other concern that they outlined was the death penalty. Is there any movement on that? And out of interest, has it been actioned in recent times?
No, we are technically a de facto abolitionist country. We've never used the death penalty since 1980 or 81. And there have been more gruesome murders than what's alleged against Fletcher, where the courts have only imposed life imprisonment, and the Crown has had no issue with that. So we've tried to explain to the United States counterparts that it's very highly unlikely that Fletcher will receive the death penalty in these circumstances. It's a borderline case between a manslaughter and a murder case. But the main issue, I understand, that they were more concerned about is that Tonga couldn't provide free legal representation for Fletcher.
There are concerns in the Cook Islands that a spat of recent fires may be arson. This is the view of retired Australian police detective Rod Henderson, who now lives in Rotunga. Mr. Henderson has been studying a series of fires over the past fortnight, and he believes there are similarities to fires around the island in 2012-2013, when multiple businesses, schools, and homes went up in flames, leading to speculations the fires were deliberately lit. The government offered a reward for information that would solve the mystery, but there were no takers. Don Wiseman asked Mr. Henderson what convinces him these latest fires are arson.
Everything points to it at this point. The one that worries me the most is a house that was completely destroyed up in the Arvachu Valley, and where two people were inside, and they're saying it's an arson. They believe it's an arson.
What else is there that points to these events being arson?
Well, on that particular occasion, it was a wet night, so the occupants of the house feel that they were targeted. I think the fire people aren't forthcoming with their analysis. They're saying that they're waiting for further evidence to come forward from their people.
You're someone who's looked at this sort of thing before in your career as a police detective working in Victoria. What can motivate someone to burn down homes, burn down commercial buildings? You know, why are they doing it?
Well, I did an article last year on all this. I went to a website, an FBI website, and I turned up an interesting article there that talked about serial arsonists, and it sort of gave a profile on them. And a lot of times these people do it for the kicks, for the excitement, to see the firefighters in action. They're indiscriminate who they pick on. They're people usually who have been in trouble with the police, loners. There's a sort of a stereotype, and they're very hard to apprehend because they don't sort of share too much about what they do.
Wouldn't you expect them to want to show off, tell their friends?
Yeah, well, you would think that, but they're very hard to catch serial arsonists, you know, because most times there's no evidentiary forensic evidence left. Everything is destroyed, and they don't usually brag, funnily enough. They will keep it to themselves, and that makes it so much harder for the police to really apprehend them.
But Rarotonga, of course, is a pretty small place. The chances of someone hiding or keeping quiet about something like this for such a long period of time, well, I mean, that sounds like a very difficult thing to do.
It does, doesn't it? And the government, after the 2012-13 events, posted a $20,000 reward for information leading to the conviction of whoever was doing it, and no one came forward. So you would think that somebody in the community knows who it is. Maybe they're protecting them, maybe they're relatives, or something of that nature, but you would think that somebody knows.
So you're absolutely convinced that these could not be naturally occurring accidents, things that have happened for which there's no immediate explanation?
Well, particularly the earlier ones where there was nobody ever caught. The police and the authorities were emphatic that they were all arson, and a serial arsonist, they go into hibernation sometimes weeks, months and even years. And it is significant, I think, at this time of the year that we're getting this small spate of fires now, which coincided with the months that they were occurring in 2012 and 13. So I'll be interested to see if there are any more and if this pattern starts to re-emerge again.
What are you suggesting should be done? Police offered a reward. What else can they do?
Well, I think what they could do, they could take the offensive and start an island-wide door knock. Go to each house in the village, particularly where the fires were occurring, get the confidence of the people, the residents there, reassure them that they're on the job, and then probe for clues or for names that these people might think could be responsible. Our people here are a little bit shy to come forward with the information on these type of things, and I think it would behove the police to get out and do a coordinated, concerted door knock to cover the whole island if it's necessary, because we don't want more lives lost. In this case, just recently, up in the valley, two ladies were in a house and were lucky to escape with their lives, and we don't want a reoccurrence of that again.
As Pacific countries more and more eye the opportunities offered by agriculture, Vanuatu last month brought farmers, scientists, and politicians from around the region together in Port Vila. One of those at the first ever Pacific Week of Agriculture was the chief executive of the Australian Centre for International Agriculture Research, Andrew Campbell. Professor Campbell has been in Wellington, New Zealand for a while, and he told Don Wiseman about the prospects for greater emphasis on agriculture in the Pacific.
In most countries, still most people are employed in agriculture or fields related to agriculture. And so the quickest way to lift people out of poverty and to improve livelihoods is to improve agricultural productivity. But that's becoming more difficult with climate change and more volatile climates, more extreme events, more intense weather events, but also changing seasonality, rainfall happening at odd times of the year and not coming when it's supposed to come. And so it is very challenging. And of course, against that, you have the backdrop of rising sea levels and saltwater intrusion into some of our most important deltas, the Mekong, for example, that feeds many, many tens of millions of people. So, yes, agricultural productivity remains crucial, but it's now more complicated. It's not just about growing more food, it's about growing healthier food and sharing it more equitably.
From a Pacific perspective, this is coming at a time when Pacific countries are realising the economic opportunity they have if they develop in a more systematic way their agriculture. And a lot of these countries, Papua New Guinea, Vanuatu, Solomon Islands, they have enormous opportunity for agriculture, don't they?
They do.
But then overlaying it is this threat from climate change. So what can they do about that?
I'm a fifth generation wool grower from Western Victoria in southeastern Australia, and when I see some of the soils that these guys have got, you could fatten a crowbar in their soils. It seems as though they could grow just about anything. And so the opportunities are immense. And when we talk agriculture, I should say we include fisheries and forestry. They're very important opportunities as well. Firstly, I think it's about understanding the resources you've got and the potential that you've got, and then work back from the markets that you can sell into. And in some cases, it's perfectly appropriate for that to be a local market or an import substitution market. Not everything's going to be a big, profitable export market. We have to be realistic about that, given the size of the population in the Pacific. But thinking about how to get it to market with a reasonable margin is really important. And some of the biggest problems in the Pacific are post-farm. We had a project in Samoa where we put thermometers inside trucks that were taking tomatoes to market, and the temperature inside the truck was getting to 60 degrees. Now, that's not flash for a tomato, so you can imagine what it was like before it even got to the market. And when it gets to the market, it's sitting out in the sun in an open-air pavilion for a couple of days. That's not a great way to achieve maximum value from your product. So it's about thinking about the whole value chain and ensuring that we've got quality control along the whole chain. And the biosecurity implications are also significant.
A critical part of it is growing resilient crops.
Yes, resilient crops in clever ways. We've had a mango project in Fiji where innovative trellising is much more robust in big storm events. And in fact, that trellising now has been copied in North Queensland. So we're getting a benefit flow from the Pacific back to, in our case, back to Australia. But thinking about protected cropping systems, I was at a nursery in Fiji a couple of weeks ago where a very innovative grower is growing tree crops in 44-gallon drums. When a cyclone comes along, he lays them down on the ground and then stands them up again after the event. He can't build a shade house or a poly structure that'll stand up to a cyclone, so he assumes that that'll all be blown away and has a more robust response. And that's the sort of thing that we need to be more clever about.
With a country like Vanuatu, which has got this big emphasis on beef at the moment, it's always had a significant beef industry, but it really wants to expand it. And it's talking about very large numbers of cattle. Is that a good thing in your view?
Well, I think the growth will need to be sustainable. And we've got excellent cattle research projects in Vanuatu through the University of Queensland. And we're showing that you can substantially increase production in a sustainable way. A general rule of thumb is it's better off to have fewer animals and feed them better than to try and grow production by just having lots more animals. And so that would be a cautionary note. And certainly from a climate change perspective, it's much more resilient if you've got fewer animals that you can look after better than being really exposed when a big event comes along.
This major agricultural show in Vanuatu, a worthwhile exercise in your view?
Very much so, yeah. It was so it was like a trade show in a way, wonderful displays of firms from right across the Pacific who are doing interesting projects. There's some wonderful stuff coming out of the Pacific. We visited one of our projects with a wonderful chocolate producer on Vanuatu, and they've just won a gold prize at the Salon de Chocolat in Paris. And their product will soon be distributed by Louis Vuitton, you know, aiming at the absolute top of the market with a premium niche single origin chocolate. So I think that's another viable pathway, is emphasising the exclusivity of authentic or artisanal Pacific product.
For all of the Pacific, as with everything, it's having the resources available. And you talked about the tomato truck that needed to be refrigerated, presumably, and they need cool store facilities and exactly. This sort of thing. And then there's the transport, the export transport. These are all difficult issues, and they're not going to be solved easily.
No. It's about choosing which crops for which markets are likely to be viable. We can't think that we can put in export-grade facilities for every crop everywhere. That'll have to be done in a very targeted way where you're coming back, as I said, from the market, knowing there's a customer there that's willing to pay and leave you a sufficient margin to ensure that it's viable in the long term. If it just depends on donor funds to get these things up, then that's unlikely to be sustainable in the long run.
Solomon Lyman's hopes it can put in place some of the ideas it learned from a recent fisheries exchange trip to Iceland. Iceland has developed from being one of the world's poorest countries to one of the richest on the back of the fishing industry. Solomon Islands Minister of Fisheries and Marine Research, Ferre Lassi, says his country wants to maximize the industry's potential. He told Sara Viatulu that Iceland's success is focused on better management and being innovative.
There are a number of points. One is control, to control the fisheries. Secondly, management and science plays a clear role. This needs to be a fundamental part of the rules of fishing based on science. And thirdly, processing, marketing and innovation. So these are the three key points.
So what is the state of the Solomon's fisheries in relation to some of the things you learned about? How can you improve from where you are at now?
Before I go on to answer that question, I want to make it clear the kind of fishery we have. It is important to to understand that salmon fisheries can be categorized into three major ones. First is the pechane fishery, the pechane fishery. Second, the long line, that is the pechane tuna fishery, and then the long line tuna fishery. And the third one is the coastal. Okay, now when it comes to industrializing the fisheries to improve the economy, we'll be dwelling more on the key fisheries involved would be the pechane fishery and the longline fishery. So in relating that back to the Iceland experience, we have to control these two fisheries. Currently, although we are benefiting from some kind of licensing, the kind of control that Iceland is referring to is not something that is in our current model. So we need to get control of this fishery.
You got to go further in terms of controlling your fisheries than just licensing.
That is right.
So will that be a big task?
Of course, it's not a straightforward thing. It will financial commitment and also the will, political and management will, to do that as well. But that can be done.
And what would you say is the second thing?
In terms of science in the Pacific, we are not that behind, because we have the SPC, who is providing a lot of assistance to the Pacific Island countries, both at the regional and national level. So this is one area that we also need to be included. And once we localize, take control through localization, we should continue to work with SPC to help us with the science bit. And then the last part is innovation, marketing and innovation. The lesson from Iceland was that any fisheries product, one or which country is involved, they need to innovate. Innovate in terms of marketing, looking at market, what sort of markets are out there and what are the customers' requirements. And then you work from there, work backwards from the customers' requirements, and then work backwards through innovations to get what they really want. So to involve the educational institutes, the research institute, with the government. So it's a state-private sector partnership that is also involved in the whole government approach to address the marketing and then the quality of the product. So this is also one area that needs to be addressed. For the third fishery, the coastal fisheries, now if we improve all the marketing and innovation, and products from the fishery can also be exported along with a product from the longline fisheries.
Now that's all we have time for on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. If you want to let us know what you think of the program, we'd love to hear from you. Also, let us know how you heard it. Our email address is focus@pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. We'll see you again very soon. Bye-bye.